Welcome to the deep dive. Think about the last time you felt that incredibly specific, tight-chested frustration.
Oh, yeah. Like the kind that bubbles up when you're trying to get a situation to just, go your way.
Exactly. Or maybe there's this fiercely stubborn person in your life and you just need them to do what you need them to do.
Right. It feels like you're standing in front of this giant industrial control panel.
Yes. With all these heavy levers and blinking buttons everywhere, and you're desperately flipping switches to fix your day or to make someone understand you.
But half the wires behind the panel are just cut. You're pulling and pulling, and literally nothing is happening.
You're just pulling dead levers, and
Hey!
you're expending a massive amount of emotional energy doing it.
Because you expect a very specific behavioral outcome from the world around you. You think there's a mechanical linkage between your effort and their action, but it simply isn't there.
Yeah, you just want the machine to work. You want to control the outcome, control how someone else is acting, or honestly, even control your own messy feelings.
Which can totally ruin a perfectly good Tuesday afternoon, by the way.
Right. It just feels like we should have a steering wheel for all of these things.
We walk around with this ingrained assumption that we should be able to control external forces and internal emotional states, too.
If we just like push the right button or pull the lever hard enough.
Yeah, and when it fails, we don't question the control panel itself. We just assume we didn't pull the lever hard enough.
Which is exactly that exhausting cycle that leaves us feeling so burned out and stuck. And that brings us to the source material for this deep dive, which is just completely disruptive.
It really is.
We are exploring a foundational document outlining the 10 axioms of choice theory. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by chaotic things in your life that you can't control, these principles operate as a manual for completely rewiring that mental control panel.
Yeah, the goal here is to dive into the mechanics of these rules, to understand not just what they are, but exactly how they function in reality.
Right. We want to construct a practical framework for you to understand your own behavior, the choices you make, and why you feel the way you do. Because these concepts aggressively challenge the default way we've been taught to navigate human interaction.
Okay, let's unpack this. Lay the groundwork for us here.
Well, the theory fundamentally redefines agency. Before we can even begin to talk about how to change behavior or improve the quality of our lives, the theory forces us to draw some incredibly harsh, non-negotiable boundaries.
Boundaries around what is actually within our power to change.
Exactly. And the very first boundary it draws is about control. Axiom one states unequivocally that the only person whose behavior we can control is our own.
Just ourselves. And then
Yeah.
Axiom 2 immediately follows that up by stating that all we can ever give another person is information.
Right. And those two concepts seem simple on the surface, maybe even obvious.
Yeah, they sound like a bumper sticker. But if you actually apply them to how you live, they dismantle the entire infrastructure of how most of us operate. What's fascinating here is how much staggering caloric and emotional energy we spend trying to dictate other people's behavior.
Operating under this false belief that we can mold them into what we need. I was actually trying to visualize this mechanical boundary, and I kept picturing driving a car on a crowded highway.
Okay, I like that. Walk me through it.
So you are the driver in your own vehicle. You have your hands on the steering wheel, your feet on the gas and the brakes. You can steer your car, and that represents controlling your own behavior. That's axiom one.
Makes sense. You're in control of your car.
Right. Now, let's say a driver in the lane next to you starts drifting dangerously close to your bumper. You can lay on your horn. That represents giving them information, which is axiom two.
Okay, yes.
But you absolutely cannot reach your arms out of your window, stretch across the highway into their window, and grab their steering wheel to correct their course. I mean, it is physically impossible.
The limitation of the horn is the crucial part of that visual. Honking the horn does not physically repel their car. It doesn't move their steering wheel a single millimeter.
It's just a loud noise.
Right. All it does is provide a loud, urgent piece of acoustic data.
Yeah.
That other driver still has to hear the horn, process the data, and make an internal choice to adjust their hands on their own steering wheel.
You didn't control them, you just informed them.
Exactly. Real life isn't always as separate as two cars on a highway.
That's what I was thinking. What about situations with intense power dynamics? Like, let's look at a workplace.
Right, the boss and the employee.
Yeah. A boss walks up to an employee and says, "You need to finish this financial report by 5 p.m. today, or you are fired." That doesn't feel like mere information. That feels like coercion. Isn't that boss fundamentally controlling the employee's behavior?
It mimics control, certainly. But if we break down the mechanics of the interaction, Even the most aggressive ultimatum is fundamentally just a data set. Yeah. The boss is providing two pieces of information. Here is a specific deadline, and here is a severe consequence. The boss cannot physically hijack the employee's nervous system and force their fingers to type the report.
Oh, wow.
The employee has to receive that information and make a choice.
So you're saying because the employee could technically choose to, I don't know, stand up, flip the desk, and walk out of the building, they are still the one driving their own car.
Exactly. They can choose to do the report. They can choose to quit. They can choose to take a nap under their desk and wait for security.
Right. The consequence of ignoring the information might be catastrophic to their career, but the steering wheel remains entirely in the employee's hands.
And when you internalize this, it radically shifts where you place the burden of responsibility in your life. The theory argues that it is mechanically impossible to control another human being.
Which means you can stop exhausting yourself trying to reach into other people's cars. Like, the anger you feel when someone won't change is often just the friction of you trying to do something physically impossible.
Precisely.
Yeah.
You're trying to turn a wheel you can't reach.
Okay, so let's say I accept that. I pull my arms back into my own car. I accept that I am safely in my own vehicle, only in control of my own steering wheel.
Okay.
Why do I still experience so much psychological distress? If I'm the only one driving, why am I so stressed out all the time?
Well, the text pivots right here to answer that, bringing the focus away from isolated individual control. Axiom 3 states that all long-lasting psychological problems are, at their core, relationship problems.
That is a heavy, sweeping claim. Like, it suggests that chronic, long-term psychological distress doesn't generate in a vacuum.
No, it generates in the space between people.
I struggled with the word all there. Yeah. All long-lasting psychological problems. What if someone is just deeply anxious about their career or their finances? That feels like an isolated internal problem, not a relationship problem.
Let's trace that career anxiety backward. Why does the career matter so much?
I mean, paying bills.
Sure, but often it's tied to the expectations of parents, the desire to provide for a spouse, the fear of falling behind a peer group, or the need to feel respected by a mentor.
Oh, I see.
The distress usually stems from a fractured, strained, or inadequate connection with others. Even the relationship we have with societal expectations is a form of relational friction.
That makes total sense. It's the connective tissue that hurts. And the document builds on this with Axiom 4, insisting that the problem relationship is always a part of our present life.
Which brings us to Axiom 5, the part of the text that I think is going to be the toughest pill to swallow for a lot of people.
Yeah, it states that what happened in the past has everything to do with what we are today, but we can only satisfy our basic needs right now and plan to continue satisfying them in the future. Wait, so past trauma doesn't matter.
I know, it requires a massive shift in how we process our own personal histories.
But does it cross the line into being dismissive? Because reading that, it almost sounds like the theory is waving away past trauma.
It really isn't, but it feels that way at first glance.
I need to figure out how to reconcile the undeniable fact that the past shapes us with this aggressive insistence that only the present matters. The way I was trying to frame it is like a weather system.
Okay, a weather system.
Let's say yesterday there was a massive torrential thunderstorm. That storm is the past. That exact storm is the reason why there is a giant, impassable mud puddle blocking your front door today.
Right, the past undeniably created your current difficult reality.
Exactly. But standing on your porch agonizing over the clouds from yesterday doesn't actually help you get to work.
Mm.
You still have to choose how to step around that puddle right now. You have to satisfy your need to move forward in the present moment.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the weather analogy captures the futility of wishing the past were different. But we can take the mechanics of it a bit further. Think of the past not just as yesterday's weather, but as the architectural foundation of a house you live in.
Okay, building a house.
The past poured the concrete, framed the walls, and maybe left a gaping hole in the roof. The past dictates the exact shape of the house you are standing in today. You can't ignore the hole in the roof.
Right.
But if you spend all your time analyzing the faulty hammers and bad blueprints used 20 years ago to build the house, you are still getting rained on today.
You have to pick up a bucket and a tarp right now.
Precisely. Many approaches to psychological distress spend years meticulously analyzing the bad blueprints. People get stuck wishing the foundation had been poured differently.
But this theory radically anchors your agency in the present.
Yes, the past built the house. But to solve a long-lasting psychological problem, which we've established is rooted in a present relationship, You must look at the interactions happening in your life today. The present and the future are the only places in time with a functioning steering wheel.
You cannot steer a car in yesterday.
You really can't.
So, if we accept that we have to navigate our present relationships to solve our distress, what exactly is the destination? What is the target we are aiming for as we steer our car around these puddles and patch these roofs?
That leads to Axiom 6. The text explains that we can only satisfy our needs by satisfying the specific pictures in what it calls our quality world.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I found this concept incredibly relatable. It essentially describes a mental Pinterest board of a person's ideal life.
A mental, highly curated Pinterest board is a fantastic way to understand the quality world. From the moment we are born, we begin collecting and storing these idealized images.
Right. We have pictures pinned up of exactly what the perfect romantic relationship looks like, what the ideal job feels like, exactly the tone of voice we expect our friends to use when they speak to us.
And we guard these pictures fiercely.
So if I understand the mechanics of this, does it mean we are just constantly walking around the real world, holding up our mental Pinterest board and trying to force reality to match our specific pictures?
That is the fundamental driver of our behavior. We are engaged in a constant, relentless comparison between what we are experiencing in the real world and the specific, idealized pictures stored in our quality world.
And the friction generated by this comparison explains almost all of human conflict.
Particularly those chronic relationship problems we talked about.
Because my Pinterest board doesn't look anything like your Pinterest board.
Exactly. Conflict sparks in two primary ways. First, when the pictures in your quality world clash with an unyielding reality, like wanting a promotion that simply isn't available.
Right.
But the second, much more volatile conflict happens when the pictures in your quality world directly contradict the pictures in someone else's quality world.
Let's put a pin in that. What does a direct collision of two quality worlds look like in practice?
Imagine a couple. Partner A has a picture in their quality world that says a loving family means working 70 hours a week to provide absolute financial security. That is their pinned image of success and love. Partner B has a picture in their quality world that says, a loving family means being home by 5 p.m. every night to eat dinner together. Both partners are desperately trying to satisfy their own basic needs by making reality match their internal pictures.
But they are mathematically incompatible. Partner A can't be at the office and at the dinner table at the same time.
And this is where the distress multiplies, going all the way back to the first rule about control. Partner B starts trying to control partner A, trying to pull the levers to force partner A to come home at 5 p.m.
Partner B starts honking the horn endlessly.
But partner B cannot reach into partner A's car. They cannot rewire partner A's quality world by force. Satisfying our needs means trying to align our present life with our internal pictures, but the catch is we have to do it without violating the reality that we cannot control the other person.
Threading that needle sounds nearly impossible. So if we know what pictures we are aiming for in our quality world, and we know we can only control ourselves, how do we physically navigate there?
Well, Axiom 7 and 8 introduce a mechanical breakdown of how we function, calling it total behavior. Axiom 7 states that all we do is behave. And Axiom 8 says all behavior is total behavior, made up of four distinct components.
Acting, thinking, feeling, and physiology.
Yes. This is the engine room of the theory. It argues that you never just feel something in isolation or just do something in isolation. Every single thing we do is a package deal of those four components operating simultaneously.
And the crux of the entire framework rests on how those four components are connected. Axiom 9 states that all total behavior is chosen, but we only have direct control over the acting and thinking components.
We can only control our feeling and our physiology indirectly through how we choose to act and think.
I love this because we can go right back to the car. Imagine you are driving a front-wheel drive car.
Walk me through the mechanics of that.
So the front wheels of the car represent acting and thinking. Those are the components connected directly to the steering wheel in your hands. When you turn the wheel, the front wheels respond immediately. You actively choose where they point.
Right.
The back wheels of the car represent feeling and physiology, like your bodily reactions, a racing heart, or a tight chest. You do not have a steering wheel for the back wheels. They don't have their own engine. They simply get dragged along the pavement to wherever the front wheels go.
The physics of that analogy align perfectly with the psychology. Consider how many people try to directly manage their emotions.
Yeah.
They sit there and think, I just want to stop feeling so overwhelmingly sad, or I need to force my heart to stop racing right now.
Yeah, we've all done that.
What they are doing is trying to reach into the back seat, open the door, and manually twist the back wheels of a moving car with their bare hands.
Which is impossible. You'll just crash the car. If you want the back wheels to turn left, you can't touch the back wheels. You have to turn the front wheels left.
Exactly. You have to change how you are physically acting and what you are actively thinking about.
It requires a strategic indirection.
If you are trapped in a state of distress, the theory suggests you must look at your front wheels. What are you doing and what are you thinking? If you choose to stand up, change your physical environment, steer the acting wheel, and consciously redirect your focus to a complex puzzle or a project, steer the thinking wheel. Your feelings and your physiology have no choice but to eventually follow.
They are mechanically tethered to your actions and thoughts. They will be dragged into a new direction.
Yes, exactly.
Which leads into the final rule of the document, Axiom 10. And honestly, the one that tripped me up the most at first, it sounds like a rigid grammar lesson. It states that all total behavior is designated by verbs and is named by the part that is the most recognizable. Why verbs? Why does a psychological framework care so much about our grammar?
This raises an important question, because language is the operating system for how we perceive our own agency. If the core argument is that all behavior is chosen, that we are steering the front wheels, then our language has to reflect that choice. Naming behavior with verbs prevents us from abandoning our agency.
Give me a concrete example of how the grammar changes things.
Consider a person who says, "I am depressed." In our standard linguistic framework, depression is treated as a static noun, a state of being, or almost like an invading entity.
It sounds like a heavy, suffocating blanket that the universe threw over them. It frames the experience as something happening to them.
Right, like saying, "I caught a cold." You didn't choose the cold ambushed you.
Yeah.
But choice theory demands we use verbs to describe total behavior. So instead of the static noun, "I am depressed," the phrasing shifts to the active verb.
I am depressing.
Yes.
I have to admit, that feels really abrasive. It almost sounds like victim blaming, like you're accusing someone of maliciously choosing to be miserable.
That is the most common pushback to this concept, and it's a vital distinction to clarify. It is not about fault or blame or malicious intent. It is purely about acknowledging the mechanics of the front-wheel drive car.
So it's mechanical, not moral.
Right. Saying "I am depressing" doesn't mean you enjoy the feeling. It means that based on the acting and thinking front wheels you are currently steering, the total behavior your system is generating is best described by the verb depressing.
So if we look at the front wheels of someone who is depressing physically, they might be isolating themselves in a dark room. That's an action. Mentally, they might be ruminating on every mistake they've ever made. That's thinking.
Exactly. They have steered their front wheels into isolation and rumination. And because the car is connected, the back wheels of feeling hopeless and experiencing physical lethargy are being dragged right along the same path.
By forcing yourself to use a verb, you remind yourself that your hands are still on the steering wheel. Huh. If you were a passive victim of a noun called depression, you have to wait for a cure to save you.
But if you are actively generating a behavior called depressing, you retain the power to stop depressing. By choosing to yank the front wheels, you're acting and thinking in a completely different direction. It is a sometimes painful but ultimately empowering realization of agency.
That is a massive paradigm shift.
It
takes the invisible, confusing parts of our emotional lives and turns them into mechanical, manageable choices.
It really does.
So what does this all mean? Let's trace the full arc of what this means for you, the listener, as you go back to your day. Number one, you have to accept the boundary of your own vehicle. You can only control your own front wheels, your acting, and your thinking.
Right.
Number two, when it comes to the people around you, you have to put your arms back inside the car. You can only give them information. You cannot force their steering wheel to turn.
Shoot.
Number three, when you feel that tight-chested distress, it is almost certainly tied to the friction in your present relationships, not just the architectural foundation poured in your past. And finally, everything you are doing right now is an attempt to force the real world to match the fiercely guarded pictures pinned to your mental quality world board.
When you synthesize it like that, it becomes clear that this isn't just a list of psychological observations. It is a completely different lens for viewing human mechanics. It removes the mystery from our misery.
You aren't just stuck in traffic at the mercy of broken control panels. You are actively choosing how to drive.
And as you take this new framework out into the real world, The ultimate test is how you handle the friction between vehicles. We know that long-lasting problems are relationship problems. We know we can only control our own acting and thinking. So consider the most difficult relationship in your life right now. What happens when the idealized picture in your quality world fundamentally requires a loved one to act in a way they simply do not want to? How do you reconcile a shared life and avoid chronic distress when you know with absolute certainty that you cannot reach over and steer their car?
Wow. It makes you look at that giant control panel with all the cut wires in a completely different light. Maybe the solution isn't trying to pull the levers harder. Maybe the solution is to finally let go of them, turn around, and grab your own steering wheel.